I'm turning this evening to the book of Proverbs, chapter 21. The book of Proverbs, chapter 21, and I read the first verse. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, as the rivers of water. He turneth it whithersoever he will. And our subject this evening is the great chasm between lost and saved. Now, we've been looking at just a random number of portions of the book of Proverbs. It would make a very long study to attempt to go all the way through to show and to demonstrate how the book moves in themes and groups of proverbs, sometimes as few as 6 or 7, sometimes as many as 15 or 16, can be shown to be dealing with particular themes. And having identified the theme, we can much better interpret and understand all the proverbs in that block, in that group. And then they spring to life, and we can see their extraordinary depth and the details of the reasoning. But tonight, briefly, I'd like us to look at an unusual set of proverbs. And proverbs, of course, really are miniature parables. That's what the Hebrew word proverb means, a parable. And they are not necessarily to be taken only at face value. Of course, they're true on the very face of the sense, but they are parables. They're speaking of deeper things. And so some of them, taken just literally, well, they're true, but they seem rather simple, seem rather insubstantial. But you never forget the theme that the proverb is addressing and the fact that it has a spiritual meaning and a spiritual sense. Then they have great depth. Well, here in chapter 21, from the first verse, there are about 12 observations, and they're unusual ones for the book of Proverbs because they're observations on the fallen state of man. And they are so profound, it's very helpful to have them. We won't be able to cover many, but each one deals with quite a different aspect of the fallen state of man. And of course it serves to give us understanding, to warm our hearts in praise and gratitude for what we've been delivered from, and to increase our sympathy and concern for all those around us in darkness. So here are 12 observations, or at least a few of them, on the fallen state of man. The first few are, first three, are preparatory. And so we look at verse 1, and I'll deal with each one fairly briefly. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, as the rivers of water, he turneth it whithersoever he will. And the first subject of the first verse, the first proverb here, is this, that man is a subject being. He doesn't realize it. Unsaved man, we've all been in this position. We don't realize it, but we are subject beings. Why the king? The king is mentioned twice in the previous chapter in quite different connection. But why here, suddenly, the king's heart? It's the only observation about a king in this particular block. And the reason would appear to be, well, the king is the most powerful person in the land. So if his heart is in the hand of the Lord, so is the heart of everyone else. That would seem to be the implied sense, the reasoning. Your heart, my heart, saved hearts, unsaved hearts, ultimately are in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, what are they? Well, they're more rivulets, streams in the Hebrew, and possibly what is suggested is irrigation and the ditches and the trenches that would be dug to divert water, to turn a large arid area into fertile land. And whoever is the farmer, whoever is responsible, will divert by different depths of trenches and so on, different quantities of water to different parts of the land according to his irrigation requirements and design. And he'll do whatever he pleases, and the water will run wherever he sends it. That would seem to be the best explanation of this illustration. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivets or rivulets of water, he turneth it whithersoever he will. Well, the king, of course, God is not making himself responsible for the sins of the king. The king may be a tyrant. He may be a violent man, a treacherous man. He is subject, as is any king, to temptation. He is under the power of the prince of the power of the air, the enemy of souls, who will tempt him. He's subject to his own lusts and desires, and God is not responsible for those. But here is the reality. If God chooses to overrule the king in any matter, at any time, if he chooses to put some good in his heart to carry out some particular person, as he put good into the heart of Cyrus, that great emperor, to issue the decree that the people of God would return to Jerusalem, if God chooses to do that, he can overwhelm and overpower the king. Much of the time, he may give him over to his lusts and to his temptations. It may be his will to do that. For example, Babylon repeatedly, the emperor, the king, was the instrument of God to chastise the people of God and to invade. Well, God may withhold his hand, or he may arrest the action of a king. He ultimately is sovereign to carry out his purposes, to discipline or to bless his people. God, through Isaiah, says, I gave Sheba for thee, Seba even, Ethiopia and other lands. I've given and directed and overruled their actions to serve the purposes of my people. And so, ultimately, even a king is a subject being. He may be very proud, but God can overrule him or put something into his heart at any time. That's, by the way, an encouragement to us. We think of the powerful man who is the president of China, and we think of the persecutions which seem to be reapplied and gathering power at the present time. But any king's heart is ultimately in the hand of God. And if we pray, then our prayers may prevail with God on high, may have been taken account of before the foundation of the world, and there may be renewed deliverance and opportunity and blessing for his people. But the very beginning of this series of problems is Proverbs, is that people are not as independent or as powerful as they imagine. And the most haughty and proud atheist isn't as independent as he thinks. He's subject to the devil, he's subject to his own lusts and temptations, and he's subject to the sovereignty of God if God chooses to restrain or to hand him over to his sin. He's a subject being. And we imagined we were free, but we were never free before salvation. The difference between a lost person is a saved and a saved person is the saved person is willingly subject to Almighty God and serves him and loves him and seeks him. But that's the first preparatory proverb. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. It's about man as a subject being and the sovereignty of God. And then verse 2, and we can deal with this very briefly. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord pondereth the hearts. And this proverb turns up in different forms, in different groups of proverbs, under other subjects. And we always take a similar proverb under the subject in which it appears. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes. This is also preparatory. God scrutinizes hearts, of course. That's the sense. He reads the motives. Man sees only his road. Every way of a man, the Hebrew is road. Every course of action, every earthly action, man sees only that. But God, well, he sees that too. And he takes account of that, and he'll judge all for their actions. Except by grace, they're forgiven their sin. But beyond that, he also reads the motives and the thoughts, the dreams, and the desires. In a few years ago, 30, 40 years ago maybe, in somewhat more moral days, 50 years ago, when even as unbelievers we would have believed in the Christian ethic and we would have sought to comply with some better standard of morality, years ago there were many people who prided themselves on living good lives. They were hostile to God, maybe. They were not believers. I've known many such. In my own family as well, in years gone by. And there were men and women, they paid their debts on time. They were scrupulous in their dealings with people. They were, most of the time at any rate, seemingly very honest. And there they were, upright people, and rather proud of it too, perhaps. But God reads the heart. Why were they that? Well, it was comfortable for them to live moral lives. People don't realize this today. But even aside from grace, there is great emotional and mental peace in morality and straightforwardness and honesty. But dear friends, these people, they lived it for themselves. And if you were to read them at the level of inner secret motives, you'd see very selfish people, very proud people, very self-righteous people. And that's the level at which God looks. Somebody may be involved in Christian service, maybe a true Christian, yet doing it for show, doing it in a flamboyant way, doing things to be seen, not for the love of God, not for the love of souls. Even that can happen. God reads the heart, the motives, the desires, the level at which we get satisfaction, and things like that. So it's just a warning to us. God reads in an entire, much more profound way than we do, and we must take that seriously. And then a third preparatory verse, and I'll just be quick, is verse 3, to do justice and judgment is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. And the meaning of this is every man and woman is born a hypocrite. That's the natural state of the fallen human heart, to be a hypocrite. Unconverted, we could very easily engage in some worship. It may be Christian, it may be pagan. Are very proud of ourselves for doing it. But to do justice and judgment is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. Or put it another way, salvation is for holiness. We're saved by grace alone. We could not achieve works of holiness, and we have utterly failed to. We cannot do it. We need the grace and mercy of God, but it's given to us in order that we should strive for holiness, to do justice and judgment, to live righteously and properly before God is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. We depend upon grace, but we have a debt, an obligation, and should have a desire for righteousness and to strive in pleasing him. And the Lord will not be pleased with his people if they depend 100% of the time on grace and do not attempt very much to strive for righteousness and holiness and conscientious, holy living. And I think of what's happening today, where you'll get some groups of people, and I have no idea what their true standing is, who will put on pop concerts rather than services of worship, and imitating all the things of this world and being thoroughly worldly, not only in behaviour but even in worship, will be bellowing out to God songs that say that they stand on the love of Christ. But the proverb says, to do justice and judgment is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. To live the life, having been saved, is more acceptable to the Lord than just to sing about grace. Of course, we should desire to do both. But to sing about grace and have not the slightest intention of obeying the Lord and leaving the world is unacceptable to God. And he'll show that it is unacceptable in our lives in some way, sooner or later. But these are preparatory verses. Now we get the observations from verse 4 which show the difference between the lot of the saved and the lot of the unsaved. Verse 4. And this is all about self-confidence and self-reliance. So take that as a heading if you wish. An high look and a proud heart, and the ploughing of the wicked is sin. If you have a modern translation, you will note that it's possible 50% of the modern translations translate this a little differently. A high look and a proud heart, and the light or the lamp of the wicked is sin. The Hebrew word translated here, ploughing, you've only got to change a couple of tiny vowel points, and it is the word for lamp. And some translators can't make sense of the ploughing, so they think it looks a little easier if they use the term lamp and assume that a small mistake has been made somewhere or something has been missed. Well, it actually works pretty well either way, but probably ploughing or tillage is right. And here's the sense. An high look and a proud heart, an authoritative look, a capable, self-reliant look. The word translated there, proud, in the Hebrew is roomy. But the translation sound, a roomy heart. That is a person who thinks he has the ability, the capacity to take up any challenge or to do anything. It's all the same, you see. A high, authoritative, confident look and a proud, capable heart. That's the unconverted. These things are valued enormously, immensely. We're independent of God. We can do things, and that's appreciated. And the ploughing of the wicked, the tillage of the wicked, and I'm sure that's the best translation. It works much better elsewhere where tillage is referred to. The ploughing of the wicked, it stands for the work of the wicked, of course. Everything they do is sin. Everything? I remember when I was first taught this years and years ago as a young Christian, everything is sin. Isn't that rather a sweeping statement? Because a person doesn't trust in the Lord and doesn't believe in him and has this authoritative manner and capable, confident, self-reliant way, everything he does is sin? Yes. Because if it isn't a sin in the action, there'll probably be a sin in the motive. There'll be a sin somewhere. It'll be tainted with sin. But the whole thing, proud independence from God, taints everything that you do and all your life. And this is the great difference between saved and unsaved. If we're saved, we've been humbled. If we're saved, that's no longer our attitude. We bring everything before the Lord. By the way, it works very well as a lamp too, if you want it that way. And the ploughing of the wicked, the lamp of the wicked, if you took it that way, it would be the knowledge, the learning, the understanding of the wicked. Well, of course it's sin, because the learning of the unbeliever and his body of knowledge leaves out the great first cause, God. He's discounted. Revelation is ignored. No light of revelation. Try to understand human nature without the revealed word of God, without any information from on high. And it means all your conclusions will be wrong and contrary to what God has said and done. And they'll be wicked. So we value humility. Doesn't mean to say we go around looking as though we're desperate failures. But nothing is done without prayer and submission to God and seeking of his guidance and asking of his blessing and seeking of the light of the word upon the things we do. And high look and a proud heart and the ploughing, the work of the wicked is sin. It's a great difference. It's for self. It's for number one. I come down to verse 5. Here is another point. Great difference between the unbeliever and the believer. One has heaven in view. The other has earth in view. What is in view? The thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, but of everyone that is hasty, only to want. Well, here's the difference between the two. The thoughts of the diligent, obviously the conscientious and the careful. But don't forget, this will have a spiritual application. Diligent before God. What is the will of God in the matter? What does God say? The thoughts of the diligent and the careful tend only to plenteousness, prosperity or blessing. This isn't just about an earthly situation. It's too trite if it's that. Every kind of spiritual blessing. But of everyone that is hasty, the word translated there, hasty, is the Hebrew verb to press or to push, oot, to press, to push. The person who pushes forward, and what is implied is in his own strength, and he does everything according to his own mind and his own desire. Well, that sometimes works pretty well in worldly things. We long for people with initiative and energy and zeal who can press issues forward. Sometimes you read the history of great battles in time of warfare, and a whole campaign has been lost because some military commander at a crucial point, crucial situation, has had no initiative and his column has stood still, or another has pressed forward. Many examples of this in World War II, where situations were saved by people who had zeal to press forward with their tank regiment or whatever it was, and the day was saved. But in spiritual things, it works the other way round. The person who is careful and considered and hesitates, well, all his planning and thinking tends to, moves to plenty and blessing, but of everyone that is hasty, only to want. So it's the difference between whether you're looking at things in a heavenly or an earthly way. Always seek guidance. Always seek help. Everything you buy, which is substantial, everything you do, which makes a great difference to your life, say or ask, is this for the cause? What effect will this have on my Christian service? Is this a legitimate part of my spiritual walk? Is it for souls? What good is it going to do spiritually and eternally in the context of my walk with the Lord? Keep up daily self-examination and prayer. The thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, read blessing. But of everyone that is hasty, presses ahead, the implication being in his own strength. So there's differences between the saved and the lost. You were a hasty person. One of the fruits of the new birth is now this scripture has moral demand upon you. You're checked a little in your movements. What are the spiritual implications, you ask? You want to be in the hand of the Lord. Then I come to the sixth verse here. And here's another big difference between saved and lost. Reality or unreality? The getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a vanity or a cloud of vapour, tossed to and fro of them that seek death. The picture is of fraud and lies and spin and manipulation. And it gives rise to something unreal. If I can illustrate from many years ago, going back to the days when most homes didn't have a washing machine and all they had is a copper and a mangle. All people went to the laundrette where there were splendid washing machines. And then washing machines began to appear. And the first ones were very, very large, inordinately slow, and horrendously expensive. But someone hit upon a way of getting into this market. And there was a relatively young businessman, and he was thought to be brilliant and so on. And he came by somebody's design for washing machine, which could be mass-produced and done cheaply. So somehow or other, he managed to acquire a failing factory, a manufacturer of razor blades, of all things, and took this over and began to manufacture his people's washing machine. And it was a fantastic success. It was about a quarter of the price of its nearest rival. And things just went on, and the investments were pouring in, and shares were being issued, hand over fist, and so on. And he was the success story of the age with this fabulous washing machine. But he was a crook. And what he was doing is, as the thousands upon thousands rolled in, because he was underpricing his machine too much and all the rest of it, well, he was just paying the workmen in the factory and paying for the goods, the raw materials, and keeping everything turning. And investment, of course, he was also paying for a fabulous lifestyle for himself. All the usual things that go on, you know. He owned racehorses, had an island home somewhere in some paradise part of the world, and was gambling and doing everything else, spending an inordinate amount of money with umpteen homes, and on it went. And the money came in and was consumed at once. Of course, just like this proverb, the getting of treasures by a lying tongue and a lot of presentation and spin is a vanity. It wasn't real. The company wasn't worth anything of the amounts everybody thought. It was a was like a cloud being tossed to and fro by a man looking for trouble. There was going to be no way out of this. And finally, he declared bankruptcy. But he was prosecuted for fraud and 101 other things and went to prison and so on. But here you are, it's exactly what was happening here many years ago now, but a perfect fulfillment of this particular sixth verse. The getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a cloud of vanity tossed to and fro of them that seek death. But now, look at it spiritually. Here's a man, in my illustration, he also will be working in the city. But he keeps the rules, if there are any rules now. He keeps them, and he's not going to be prosecuted. He's done very well. He's bought a splendid home. His family are now grown up. He's got lots of money in the bank. Everything is good and fine and comfortable for him, and so on. And his life is very stable. But viewed spiritually, he's actually in exactly the same position as this other man. Viewed spiritually, one day his life is going to be taken, and in an instant he'll be in the next world and standing before God in judgment, and he'll have nothing. Can't take his small fortune with him. He has no holiness before God. He has no forgiveness. He's never worshipped him. He's never served him. His whole life is a mirage, a desert mirage. His whole life is as unreal as the washing machine company of this other magnate. And that's the parable of verse 6 applied spiritually. The getting of treasures by a lying tongue. Where was the lying tongue of my illustration? He kept the rules in the city, but he had a lying tongue because he didn't believe in God. And he explained life by falsehoods. There is no God. It's all a sheer accident. There is no judge. There is no maker. I owe no homage. I owe no thanks. The getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a vanity. So, it describes every unsaved life in these terms. And by implication, the believer has solid treasure and joy. The getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a vanity tossed to and fro of them that seek death. You could apply it to the church. There have always been people, some of them may have meant well, who thought you could build churches by spin and by emotional preaching. Get people to make decisions for Christ, any means you can. What counts is results. What counts is numbers. What counts is bodies in the pews, not repentant hearts, not real seekers, not real conversion and transformation of life. Get them in anyhow you can. Borrow from the world, as I said earlier. Play the world's music. Do it the world's way. Turn your preachers into masters of ceremonies and comedians and everything else. Get the people in. The getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a vanity. It's hollow. What you produce is a megachurch. Well, some of the people may be true believers, but the vast majority won't be. They've been tricked, baited, brought in, told they can have the world and the Lord at the same time. And ultimately, the whole thing is going to collapse. And you see that happening in different parts of the world, where vast megachurches have already moved from being at least orthodox in their belief to being completely heretical in their beliefs. And it happened in a matter of a few years. And it could happen because most of the people were never truly converted. So when the doctrines changed, they were quite happy. They changed their mind about things. No, dear friends, conversion brings us to reality. Conversion brings us to find the Lord, really, and true worth and true riches, to believe in true conversion, and to labour and pray for these things and for a work of the Spirit. Verse 7. Time is rushing on and I must come to conclusion. But look at this. The robbery of the wicked shall destroy them because they refuse to do judgment. And this is about self-hurt, if you like. One of the tragic things about being lost, being unconverted, is that it's full of self-hurt. We hurt ourselves only. The picture is of bandits in the desert, the robbery of the wicked. But these bandits incur no end of injury. The robbery of the wicked shall destroy them. The Hebrew word translated destroy, actually this is in your margin, if you have a margin Bible, is saw them, S-A-W, cut them severely. The robbery of the wicked shall cut them. Perhaps our translators have been a bit strong in saying destroy. Some modern translations, though, go way off the track and they say the robbery of the wicked shall sweep them away. The idea of the saw suggests to their mind, oh, this must mean sweep away. But no, the robbery of the wicked shall harm them, shall cut them. Why? Well, because there are guards on some of these camel trains and they fight back. And the brigand, the bandit, has wounds to display from various attempts at taking caravans and so on off the desert roads. The robbery of the wicked shall destroy them. Some large cities, to protect their trade routes, would send out militia and there'll be conflicts. So by being a bandit, you don't get off scot-free in ancient times. You know you're going to incur injury. There's going to be conflict and there'll be problems. The robbery of the wicked shall saw or cut or destroy them because they refuse to live proper, honest lives, to do judgment. That's the proverb. That's what it means. But it's so with lost people, you apply this spiritually. Before we come to the Lord, we are harming ourselves non-stop. We increase in cynicism. We go further from God. We become more subject to our lusts. We suffer all kinds of disappointments. And ultimately judgment from God. It's self-harm, unbelief. It's very sad. And then look down to verse 8. I hope you don't mind my going through all these. So the theme is different every time. Every proverb tells you something quite different about the difference between the believer and the unbeliever. Verse 8, the way of man is froward, that means perverse. The Hebrew is literally twisted, upside down. The way of man is froward and strange. There the Hebrew word is foreign. Well, what is intended is this. If you know somebody from a far off land, their culture and their ways are different. You find it strange. You don't understand them at first. Actually, their culture may make much more sense than ours if we only knew. But the point is, we don't understand it, so we find it strange. And that's the sense here. The way of man, some translations scratch their heads and say, well, this is not understandable, so we will say the way of the wicked. But no, the original says the way of man. This is a generalization about all people, unsaved. The way of man is perverse and strange, very difficult to understand. He's unreasonable. He's not logical in his unbelief. But as for the pure, his work is right. So this is about the twistedness of man by the fall. He's perverse. Well, he is. And I was, and you were, before conversion. We set out on a journey, the journey of life. And we don't know where we're going, and we have no map. And there is a map, but we refuse it. And we refuse the compass. And if somebody were to say, where are you going? Our reply is, I don't know. I'm just going out. I don't know where I'm going. Well, how perverse. How strange. But viewed spiritually, that's how we set out on the journey of life, without God. We don't know where it's going to lead. And we don't have the right equipment for the journey and the right clothing for the journey, spiritually speaking. And we do all those things that are not good for us. So some people eat themselves to death. Isn't that perverse? Isn't it strange? Why is he still eating? Why are you eating? Oh, I like comfort foods. Comfort foods that may be killing us. Then there's somebody else and he's drinking. But by drinking, he's abdicating his human personhood and knocking out his higher senses and making himself halfway to being a fool. He's abdicating humanhood. Crazy. He's perverse. He's strange. And that's what we did before conversion. The proverb is true. And we hate God, the greatest benefactor in the universe, the only true benefactor in the universe. And we hate God, the only healer in the universe. And we hate God, the great giver in the universe, and the teacher of deep things, wonderful things, good things. Why hate a benefactor, a healer, a giver, a teacher? How perverse. How strange. The more I look at man, the less I understand him. He's a crazy person before conversion. He's illogical. He lusts and breaks his marriage, which was full of love and affection and real companionship and delight. And for lust, he smashes it up. He's a crazy being. And he accumulates only to lose it all at the end of life. The way of man, it's an understatement, is froward and strange. The difference between being lost and being saved. Now we can look back and see all these differences. And each one is touched on in one of these different proverbs. Our time is up. I was going to deal with verse 9. I'd have to apologize to women in dealing with verse 9. Just to remind you that Solomon, most of his misbehaving people in the book of Proverbs are men. There's only the very occasional objectionable lady. So don't take too badly verse 9. It is better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house, a wealthy place. There's a price to pay for wealth. There's a price to pay for fame. Why the corner of the housetop? Well, because that's where the pious man or woman went to pray. That's where David went to pray. That's where the Apostle Peter in the book of Acts went to pray. Better to dwell in the corner of the housetop in communion with God than surrounded by the trappings of wealth and a contentious wife because you married for beauty rather than for character, maybe. Well, it's another subject. I really must come to a close. But those are just some proverbs that are observations on the differences between the saved and the lost. And it brings us to prayerful sympathy for all who are lost. Anyway, let us close singing together.